This week on Making Contact.
Sometimes when I help people, just the smile on those people's faces keep me going.
And while we are in struggle, we cannot let the dance go. Because if we let the dance go, then the system has won.
Women are gaining influence as leaders throughout the world, fighting for peace, justice, the environment, and civil society. In this program, we profile three courageous grassroots activists. Shireen Isoff is an advocate for democracy and women's rights in Zimbabwe. Sahar Saba is a leader in RAWA, the underground resistance organization struggling for women's rights and democracy in Afghanistan. And Wendy Pakur represents farm workers in South Africa. I'm Sandina Robbins, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. This program is a special collaboration with the Women Rising Radio Project. Shireen Isoff was born into a family that helped spearhead the Chimurenga, the struggle for liberation that transformed colonial Rhodesia into an independent Zimbabwe. She grew up with the politics of the time, and she was profoundly influenced to become a political activist for democracy and women's rights.
I was always the one who tagged along, I guess, without the language or the understanding necessarily of what it was that was going on. But certainly with these impressions of people talking politics in an intense way, of people singing the liberation songs in an intense way. So that captured my imagination in a very, very specific way. And I would dance the dances. I mean, the resistance dance that comes out of Zimbabwe is known as the Toy Toy, which then got translated into South Africa, interestingly enough, and was taken up in support of struggles, popular struggles and resistance there. The liberation struggle songs, I mean, there's a very, very famous and popular song which is called Mbuya Nehanda. For those who are familiar with the history of Zimbabwe, Nehanda was a woman who actually was key in mobilizing people to rise up in what was known as the first Chimurenga historically. And she's a woman that's actually been immortalized almost as an important ancestral spirit. So there's a song that evolved from there that goes, Mbuya Nehanda gufara uwe awanda. So, you know, we're going to rise up in the name of Nehanda, and we're going to fight this war and liberate our people and claim the land. From 1994 through to the end of 2000, I had been working with an organization known as the Zimbabwean Women's Resource Center Network, which was one of about 20 organizations that was really, really focusing on women's rights within Zimbabwe. So a lot of the work that I was doing was around women's access to land, access and control of land. In the Zimbabwean context, women cannot own land in their own right, even though we have the legal age of majority at 18. But the way that customary law and civil law collude, and patriarchy, obviously, within that, means that women are continuously marginalized and dispossessed and vulnerable. So a lot of the work at the Zimbabwean Women's Resource Center Network was about that. So everything from land, access to education, HIV/AIDS, housing, microcredit, and economic strategies. Every single day of our lives, we are engaging in struggle as women against a patriarchal capitalist system that is intent on using our labor and our bodies and exploiting our labor and our bodies to keep the system going. So the struggle exists. And why would we struggle if not for the things that are contained for me in the dance? And the things that are contained in the dance is where our strength lies. The thing that capital doesn't have is an understanding of what it is to be human. And that set of things is for me what is located within the dance. It's about the valuing of another human life. It's about the compassion. It's about the love. It's about the reaching out across time and space to be in solidarity with people who are in struggle. Because as the phrase goes, and it's a phrase that I believe in, I mean, none of us is free until all of us are free. So the struggle and the dance. And while we are in struggle, we cannot let the dance go. Because if we let the dance go, then the system has won.
Since the mid-1990s, Shireen and millions of others were driven out of Zimbabwe by the collapse of culture and economy under the Mugabe regime. Settling in South Africa, she joined the exile organization called the Crisis in Zimbabwe Coalition. Reflecting on her activist work and developing herself as a writer, Shireen draws from Africa's rich oral tradition of the griot to raise political awareness. Here, Shireen shares one of her stories about organizing South Africa's lowest paid workers.
So the story is searching for Jessica. And on this particular day, there was some information in terms of a broadsheet that needed to be distributed amongst workers, just updating people on what was happening in terms of certain sets of negotiations, etc. And I decided that I would walk down the hill, which is where I knew Jessica worked, in order to give her the broadsheet so that she could distribute it to people in her vicinity. So I took the walk down. This is at the University of Cape Town, and entered into a set of buildings that are designed almost as a maze, but they are numbered from 1 to 10. Now, I entered at a certain point in this complex where I was immediately met with office number 9. So I went into the office and I said, I'm looking for Jessica. Do you know where I can find her? And the people in the office looked at me and became a little bit puzzled. And the one particular woman said to me, there's no Jessica working here. So I thought, okay. I left office number 9 and went into office number 7. Jessica, what does she do? So I say, she's a cleaner. She works for this particular company. She's a cleaner. And I know that she works in this complex. I've met her many times and I know that she works here. Sorry, we can't help you. There's no Jessica working here. So I wander through the building and I see the red cone on the floor with the signs, floor wet, slippery, beware. And I think, ah, there's a visible marker that there's a cleaner around. So I run to the cone and sure enough, there's one of the cleaning staff. And I say to him, I'm looking for Jessica. Do you know where I can find her? And he says to me, what is the time? And I say, I look at my watch and I say, it's 10:30. And he says to me, at 10:30, Jessica is at student health. So you must go to office number 5 and you'll find her there. So I trundle along to office number 5 and I walk in and the nurse who staffs student health is at the desk and I say, I'm looking for Jessica. And she says to me, there's no Jessica working here. And at that point, I became enraged because what was happening was that Jessica was written under erasure, to use the words of Spivak. She was written out. Her labor mattered. If each of those 11 officers had not been cleaned, they would have known that Jessica wasn't there to clean the office. But Jessica was written out. So I said to the nurse, I know that she's here. I've been told that she's here. Please could you go and find her? And she said, all right, fine. She went into the back. And a minute later, out came Jessica. And she had her sleeves rolled up. And she had a duster in her hand. And she walked out of the door, the back door of the student health offices. And she saw me and her eyes lit up.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. Today's program is a special collaboration with the Women Rising radio series, a project of Crown Safira Productions. If you'd like more information, or for a cassette or CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit us on the web at radioproject.org. Sahar Saba is an activist with RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan. She came to RAWA as a young Afghan girl to study in one of RAWA's underground schools when girls and women were barred by the state from getting an education. Sahar and her family discovered RAWA while they were in exile, struggling to survive in one of the hundreds of refugee camps in Pakistan.
Life was not easy because we had to live in the tents and there was no education or especially freedom for women, and none of our male members of the family had any job. And so it was a new country, new place for us. So the biggest impact that had life there was that there was no education, and especially my father, who is an educated man, wanted his children to be educated, and then there was no way. I started learning Quran with my grandmother, and I thought at least that will be something so I can read and write and it will help me. But I'm happy that my father didn't give up. He was going to the city in Peshawar, and he had some friends, and finally some of his friends told him about RAWA and its underground schools, which were very far, like 2 days, two nights by train. Luckily, my father decided. And so after living 2 years in the refugee camp, we went, I with my brother and two other girls in the family, we went to RAWA school in Quetta, Pakistan. And the education there was very simple. They started like in any other school, from the alphabet with us and then giving us books and how to read and write and all. And then talking to us in very simple words about the political situation in the country and about women's issues and about our personal life and experience. And that's how they started to raise awareness and not simply be limited just to all the subjects that are common to be taught in other schools.
RAWA involves thousands of women in social and political activities aimed at securing basic human rights for women in both Afghanistan and Pakistan. As more and more women joined RAWA's secret networks, it became a strong voice for democratic and secular values under the leadership of Mina, a young Afghan woman who initiated the work of RAWA in 1977. Like Zimbabwe's Nehanda, Mina is more than a heroine for Afghan and Pakistani women. She, too, has become an ancestral spirit, a beloved icon. Mina is a role model for Sahar Saba.
Mina is, from one hand, she was just a woman like many other women in Afghanistan. She was coming from a background that many RAWA members are coming from. But why she was different, why she became a symbol of struggle and resistance for women in Afghanistan, because she really paved the way. She really had the strength and really had the courage to take the first steps, forming an independent organization of women. She knew that it's not easy. She knew that it can cost her life. And from the very beginning, she was really a source of inspiration. Many have stories that how she worked very hard in Kabul at that time, wearing burqa, in despite of being sick physically, and how she helped hundreds of women and the families who had lost someone from their family or were in the prison, and also how outspoken she was to raise awareness and to talk about the political issues in Afghanistan. So that's why I think she has really a special place in the history of Afghanistan. She's the first political woman that really gave her life for the cause of freedom and democracy. When people ask us, in such a dangerous situation, what makes you to continue the struggle, I think what really makes it easier for us, and I can say for me personally, is that if Mina could give her life, so any of us can be another Mina. And that's what she taught us.
Mina was assassinated in 1987 by Afghan agents of the KGB and members of an Islamic fundamentalist party. Many of Rawa's key activists have been imprisoned and tortured, so Rawa members must work under very tight security restrictions. Yet they've maintained their network of underground schools, built and equipped hospitals, published a feminist magazine, and continued to organize very visible annual demonstrations of women. Sahar Saba helps to organize these demonstrations for democracy and women's rights.
The reason that we have demonstrations is to really use this opportunity to raise our voice and to remind the people around the world and also in Pakistan and Afghanistan that these fundamentalists cannot be forgiven. It's not easy to organize a demonstration of, at least in each of our demonstrations, we have more than 1,000 women and children, or in some even men. It takes sometimes months for security issues, for financial problems to organize the demonstrations. But many of the women who have come to participate in these demonstrations, they really consider this as the most important part of their life. And many have really said that these demonstrations have made them, they have changed them, and they have really given them the courage that they can do anything, even in the history of Pakistan. In Afghanistan, of course, it was the first time that women with very strong voices for political change in Afghanistan and being so outspoken were on the streets and really fighting the fundamentalists.
Sahar Saba would like the United States to support the struggle of organizations like Rawa working to bring secular democracy to Afghanistan. She says the United States is currently backing the worst elements in Afghan leadership.
We all know that the United States will punish the Taliban, but at the same time, it was our people who again paid, who had to pay the price of what the Taliban did, or the Al-Qaeda and Osama, who were in fact supported and funded by the United States. But the question was who will come to power. And from the first days, we saw that the United States chose to work with the criminals, the warlords. And today, if we see this government, which is called the new government, but in fact it's the government of the same people, mainly the warlords, sitting in the cabinet, having the most important posts, and which is the main and root cause behind having not many changes in Afghanistan. People need jobs, people need food, people need homes, people need education, people need much more. People need, first of all, security, which we don't have. And I, as a woman, definitely I would like to see women in that Afghanistan in completely in a different position, where they have equal rights with men. They are really in the public scene, and they are really part of the decision-making process of their country.
Vimbo, vimbo mfana. Vimbo, vimbo mfana. Vimbo, vimbo mfana. Vimbo, vimbo mfana. Vimbo, vimbo mfana.
Wendy Pakur is an activist and organizer for Sikulo Sonke, a new South African trade union created by the Women on Farms Project. Wendy grew up on a South African farm owned by whites and saw firsthand the oppression of her own family and other black farm workers.
What was life
like growing up on the farm, it was tough sometimes. Sometimes it was very difficult. At that time, there was no legislation protecting farm workers. You had no rights as a farm worker, so these people could do everything to you. The weekly wages for farm workers is 200 rand per week. It's 6 rand to the dollar, so that will be $33 maybe. That is 200 rand per week. But what's happening, seasonal workers have to do piecework and they normally don't get that minimum wages. In most cases, people don't have access to gloves when they work with the pesticides. And you should see some of the people's hands. It's full of rashes, skin infections, or they don't have the mask while spraying in the vineyards or orchards. And sometimes it's mostly women who work in the orchards, and it will be a man driving the tractor, spraying the fruit. And so sometimes they have to stay in the vineyards while spraying the pesticides, and that's a big health problem. The other issue is when the men finish work or when the women finish work, there's no bathrooms or restrooms or thing to wash their hands or their clothes, so they have to take it home. And that is also a health issue, because when the women have to wash the overalls and things, they'll also get some of the pesticides on their skins. Some people even get blind of pesticides, like when the pesticides go into your eye, sometimes you get blind.
Wendy left her family on the farm to go to school, but eventually she had to find a job to help support them. So she joined the ranks of factory workers in South Africa, whose conditions were not much better than the farm workers.
I matriculated in 1996, and by that time my grandparents already retired, so they were old and only getting a monthly pension, which are very little money. So I had to help them to buy food, to pay the rent, to pay the water and all of that. So when I came into the factory, one of the things was very low wages. Benefits was one of the other things we didn't get. So some of the union officials come to us and ask, do you want to join the union? Then we said, yes, we want to join the union. Because we've met several times what management were the employers, and they didn't want to recognize us as workers. They didn't listen to our demands. So we decided, okay, we'll join the trade union. So I was chosen to be, or elected to be, a shop steward. We were fighting. We were really in a fight for better wages, for better benefits and all of that. And they were starting to victimize me as a worker. I was sexually harassed by one of the management in the factory. And when I told the manager, the boss, that I was sexually harassed by the floor manager, he told me, as long as I'm 18 years and older, he don't worry. He don't care. The manager came to me then and said, you can be a junior manager, then you have to leave the union. But I refused. And after I refused, they were harassing me. And it was in the beginning of 2002. I resigned at the factory. Yes. And after that, I had no employment. I had to sit at home. And I was worried because I had to help my grandparents. I have a child. At the time, she was only 1 year old. And how will I be able to feed my child and all of that? So at that time, I've joined the organization called Women on Farms Project. Women on Farms Project is a non-profit service organization who strive to build the capacity of all women working and living on farms. We do this through gender-based education, lobbying and advocacy work, and organization building support. We've got different capacity building programs, women's health, labor rights, social security, economic development. Then we've got a youth program. In 2003, Women on Farms Project and the beneficiaries from the farm workers' communities, which has served since 1996, has decided to establish an independent trade union now known as Sikulasonke. And Women on Farms Project commits itself to actively build and support Sikulasonke. And I'm an organizer for this membership organization, Sikulasonke, who promotes women leadership, membership control, community involvement, unity of all farm workers, communities, empowerment of all, and self-organization.
Wendy Pacour is very proud of the work of Sikolo Sonke and its success in strengthening the union movement among the poorest and most exploited of South Africa's workers. She also loves her own work as a labor organizer and has enthusiastically represented Sikolo Sonke on speaking tours outside South Africa. Wendy is eager to tell success stories from her work in the field.
There was this woman called Mariam, and she came to our office because the farmer wanted to evict her, and sometimes he beat her because he wanted her off the farm. And the problem was she was HIV and AIDS positive, and that's something that we're not supposed to talk about. So I tried to help the women because she didn't want to disclose her status. Her body wasn't strong enough to go and work, so we had to facilitate the process. We had to help her children, and she even had hearing problems. So we worked with one of the social workers in that area to communicate with this person. And she's still on that farm, and she's doing fine. There's no assaults, no beating from the farm owner, because we had several chats over the phone with the farm owner. We've set up some meetings and things like that. So she's doing okay. So if I can help people, if I can make a difference, that's what keeps me going. Sometimes when I help people not being evicted, and just a smile on those people's faces keep me going. Sometimes when I help people getting more wages or getting an increase or getting a bonus, that's what keeps me going. So if I can make a difference, I will do that, even if I have to go at night to people's houses. Sometimes people come to my house and I never say no. I never say no. I won't be there to help you. So whenever people need me, I'm available. Because I went through different things in my workplace environment and there was no one helping me. So I felt terrible and I felt sad and all of that. So if I can help people being happy, then I will do that. Even if I had to do this forever. Yes, I must just tell you that in some government departments, they had some great jobs and so forth. And in some occasions, I was asked if I'm interested in that job, I would have get more benefits, more pay, and in some occasions, housing subsidies. And I would have been permanent because I'm a contract employee now. But then I refused because I said, I'm a people's person. I want to work in the field with people where I can make a difference.
That's it for this Women's Desk edition of Making Contact. These profiles of international changemakers were co-produced with Lynn Feinerman's Women Rising radio series, a project of Crown Safira Productions. You can learn more about the work of these courageous women at radioproject.org. If you'd like to order a CD copy of this program or make a donation, our toll-free number is 800-529-5736. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Special thanks to Pauline Bartoloni for production assistance. Lisa Rudman is our executive director. Peggy Law is our founding director. Senior producer Tina Rubio, associate producer Justin Beck, Dorian Taylor, communications manager, Tom Evans, development associate, Esther Manilla, outreach coordinator. And I'm your host, Sandina Robbins.